from NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Digital surveillance and student privacy. A little later in the show, we'll have an in-depth discussion about why many school districts are turning to technology to prevent or try to prevent school shootings. But first, the House votes on the ground rules for the impeachment inquiry today. That sets up the possibility of public hearings as the inquiry moves forward. We're already hearing how Democrats and Republicans are both framing the issue, both parties putting even today's procedural vote in historic terms. Well, what does history actually tell us about this moment? How does it compare to past impeachment proceedings? So joining us from Dallas, Texas is Jeffrey Engel. He's founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University. He's also co-author of the book Impeachment, An American History. Jeffrey Engel, welcome to On Point.
Hi, good to talk to you.
So first of all, just tell us briefly, even right now in this moment, as the House is debating the rules for the impeachment inquiry itself, how does that compare to previous impeachment proceedings we've seen before? Has the process played out in the same way?
You know, the process has played out in the same way, in the most fundamental way possible, which is that the Constitution gives the House the absolute right to impeach, and the House, in every instance that there has been impeachment under discussion, has essentially looked back to the past for ideas, for precedent, but not precedent that's binding. In each case, we see the House rewriting the rules, obviously in 1868 with President Johnson writing the rules for the first time originally, but in 73, 74, and then in 1999 for Bill Clinton's impeachment, the House looked back, recognized that there were some things they liked, some things they didn't, and rewrote the rules to fit the modern times that they were dealing with. I should point out as well that if this ever gets to the Senate, if there is a formal impeachment of the president, the Senate, too, will look back, take some ideas from the past, but more importantly, write their own rules anew. So they're basically doing their constitutional duty as prescribed.
I see. But as you well know, Republicans are lambasting even today's vote, saying that the inquiry has already begun. So today's vote is essentially, they're calling it, you know, a sham.
Well, you know, I think the Republican strategy here is politically brilliant and historical bunk. And I mean that both in a complimentary and a negative sense, because the truth is there is no requirement for an actual authorization vote. Every vote and every case has been idiosyncratic. Nixon's was not like Johnson's. Clinton's was not like Nixon's. And in every case, there has been essentially a process that unfolds behind closed doors, a process that unfolds with investigations and in committee, and then moves out into the public sphere. And what's fascinating about, you know, the current Republican critique of the process is that it essentially ignores the fact that the ultimate vote and the ultimate information is, by its very nature, a public vote. So I think the Republicans are doing a really smart job in basically trying to bog down the question of process, trying to call it this a partisanship event, which is exactly what Democrats did in 1999 when Republicans were in the majority, because the more you talk about partisanship, the more the American people stop believing that this is a legitimate process. So it's politically wise for them to do this, but there really is very little historical evidence and backing for their claims.
I see. So we've seen a similar use of sort of extreme language or putting, you know, members of Congress themselves putting these in extreme historical terms before in impeachments past.
Yes, most definitely. You know, and I mean, same exact words, same exact language. You know, in 1974, Gerald Ford talked about who, of course, succeeded Nixon upon his resignation. You know, even weeks before Nixon's resignation, was still referring to the entire impeachment as a kangaroo court. And Richard Nixon often called it a witch hunt. By the same token, Democrats in 1999 really talked about it being a coup against the president and also overturning the will of the people. And for them in 1999, much like for Democrats today, who obviously are in the opposite camp, you know, they have the argument on their side that not only did the American people vote the president in, But in both cases, these impeachment discussions are occurring after a midterm election in which the president's party was, and to some extent, repudiated. In 99, Republicans lost, excuse me, 98, Republicans lost very badly, having already announced and declared their intention to impeach. And that was really seen as a referendum in many ways on the very impeachment question in the midterm elections, that the American people were not interested in going forward. Nonetheless, they did go forward with the impeachment through a lame duck session Congress, and ultimately that was viewed by the American people as being in itself an illegitimate use of power, and not the illegitimate use to remove a president, but an illegitimate use to remove a president who was, in fact, not only reelected, but in many ways vindicated in the midterms.
So, you know, let's focus a little bit more then on the Clinton impeachment. And again, just to remind folks, the House today is voting on the impeachment inquiry. It's not a full impeachment vote by any means. But it seems to me that a major difference between what happened in the Clinton administration and what's happening now with the Trump administration is that President Clinton denied, right, that he vehemently denied that he had done anything wrong, or that even he denied all the allegations against him. Whereas we have with President Trump, he's not denying that he made these phone calls, et cetera. So it seems as if the question facing members of Congress regarding President Trump is actually a little bit different than it was with President Clinton.
You know, I think we have to remember where we are. I think that's a great observation, but we have to remember where we are in the process, which is to say, at this point in the process for Nixon, or even in the process for Clinton, all the evidence had not come out yet, because we did not have the formal reports from committees, or in the case of Clinton, the formal report from the Starr investigation, which looked into, originally a land deal that went bad, but of course morphed over time into a general investigation of the president's behavior, which ultimately revealed his inappropriate behavior. The issue in the Clinton era, we should remember, was one of lying under oath for a deposition, which meant that the House, by the time it got to vote, had full information that the president had lied. Mm. So, if you will, we are in the period from 1999 where we're still awaiting the Starr report. We're still awaiting the full information, and the investigations are still going on. So ultimately, if a vote occurs, we're going to be in the same position of having evidence that tells us that the president did something, and perhaps even did something wrong. In Clinton's case, nobody doubted that Clinton had lied. The question was, is that a high crime? In Trump's case, as you point out, the president has admitted to what he is being accused of. So people are going to have to discuss not whether or not he did it, but does it matter, and is it enough of an issue to remove him from office? So in that sense, I think looking down the road, we're going to have actually remarkably similar set of cases for Clinton and Trump, though with one key difference. Obviously, Clinton's was a domestic personal issue of lying, and in Trump's case, in some form or fashion, we don't know the full details yet, involves a foreign power, and that's obviously a completely different realm.
Well, so then if we move forward to having public hearings, what does history tell us about the difference those hearings might make, if any?
Oh, a huge difference, because, you know, anything out in the public, I mean, we can actually look back beyond impeachment hearings to other near impeachment hearings, if you will. You know, obviously Iran-Contra being a great example. Whenever the public hearings occur, it's not a moment for gathering information, which, by the way, is a point that Republicans who were in the majority made time and time again in 1999. The good investigative material comes out in private. The public is about performance and is about helping the people understand which side of the aisle their representatives are on, and therefore which side of the aisle they might choose to follow. Great example is that the key piece of evidence that ultimately undid Richard Nixon was that he had privately and secretly kept a taping system in his Oval Office, which meant that there were tapes of all the conversations. That information was at first revealed in private session, in closed session, by, of all things, a Republican lawyer, because Republicans and Democrats are allowed to ask questions back in 73, 74, just as they will be going forward under the current rules, if approved. that piece of private information was revealed several days before it was then, if you will, publicly revealed by a congressperson who asked the question, is there a taping system, knowing that he had already been told there was a taping system, did it completely for public effect, and that's what began to move the process politically forward, if you will.
I see. So we've talked about Clinton, we've talked about Nixon. What do you think the lesson is to draw from the 1868 impeachment of President Johnson?
This is actually a really interesting one, because we've talked about process, we've talked about politics, but in Johnson and Nixon's case, we haven't yet talked about the personalities involved. And Johnson was essentially impeached for two fundamental reasons. The first was fundamentally that he was not Abraham Lincoln, which is a difficult bar, I'll grant you. But he was impeached because he wasn't doing what Republicans expected Lincoln would have done on Reconstruction. But the other thing that he was impeached for, in very real terms, was the fact that he was personally unpopular and an unpleasant person, and that he was acting in a manner that the House did not deem becoming of the president. He was acting unpresidential. He had insulted the integrity of the Congress. He had lied, they argued. He had basically made politics into a personal series of criticisms of individuals. And what that meant was that, first of all, those were perhaps easily dismissed charges as being impeachable offenses. But it also meant that when Johnson turned around and said, where are my allies, there were very few people that wanted to stand up and defend Johnson because they liked Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
They ultimately defended him either because they thought the impeachment was inappropriate and unconstitutional, which, by the way, the Supreme Court subsequently ruled was the case on the Tenure of Office Act, which was the initial instigating act. But Johnson had very few personal friends, if you will. So people who were really, really willing to go to the mat for him because they liked him, not just because they thought it was politically expedient. That could be a similar case that we're seeing today.
Well, Jeffrey Engel is director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University and co-author of Impeachment, An American History, speaking to us from Dallas, Texas. Jeffrey Engel, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
Well, when we come back, we'll take a look at the rise of digital surveillance on American school students. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Cameras in schools, metal detectors, elaborate visitor check-in procedures, those are safety procedures that are common in many American schools. But it wasn't until after the Parkland, Florida school shooting last year that digital surveillance really took off. Now, there are a number of companies that will partner with school districts to monitor what kids say and do online, and will monitor them all the time. The companies say they've prevented suicides and thwarted potential shooters. Educators and politicians and parents say this technology will keep schools safe. But some aren't so sure. They're worried about student privacy, freedom of expression, and whether there's actual evidence that this does work to keep schools safe. So the idea of constant digital surveillance of American students, what do you think about that? Is it too big brother for you? Or do you think this is exactly the kind of safety system we need in place to meet kids where they are, which is largely online? Well, joining me now from Berkeley, California is Lois Beckett. She's a senior reporter for The Guardian, and her article last week is headlined, Under Digital Surveillance, How American Schools Spy on Millions of Kids. And we've got a link to that at onpointradio.org. Lois Beckett, welcome to the program.
Great to talk with you.
So I wonder if you could start by just giving us an example. I mean, one of the examples that you use right at the top of your story about how a Missouri school district decided it wanted to turn to a form of digital surveillance on its students.
So schools for a long time have monitored what kids do on the internet in a very basic way by blocking certain websites like porn sites, sort of limiting what students can search for on school computers. What we're talking about now is something very different than that. It's technology that integrates with students' school email addresses, the shared Google documents that they're using to do school assignments, their chats to each other. And so what happened in the school district in Missouri is one Friday night last fall, the school principal of the middle school in Afton, Missouri, was just sitting at home watching TV, and he gets an alert on his phone. The alert comes from a surveillance company, Bark, that scans everything that students are writing in emails to each other or in documents. So on that Friday night, one student had written to another student an email talking about self-harm, and the tech company immediately tipped off the principal, and the principal immediately called the mother of the student who had written that email. And so within literally minutes, the principal was on the phone with a parent talking about the situation, asking if the student was safe. And that kind of thing is now happening all the time in schools across the country.
And beforehand, what did school officials rely on? Students warning them that their friends had been saying certain things?
Exactly. So we're talking about a situation in which this principal said, you know, what's great about this technology is we don't have to wait for students to decide if they want to talk or to feel that the betraying their friends or like tattling on their friends, because essentially the AI will tattle for them.
Okay. So but are the districts that use this technology, are they monitoring the electronic communications that are sort of under the district's umbrella? Because you mentioned Google, and there's lots of Google for school, right? So the kids can talk to each other through that or write those emails or documents that you said. But there's also, what about all of their accounts outside of that umbrella? Does this software monitor all that?
So it really depends on the company and the school district. What I was looking at primarily was monitoring of school computers, school accounts, not schools monitoring students' private cell phones or their individual social media accounts. But that gets messy because sometimes you use a school email address to sign up for your Instagram account, and then some of those alerts will come back to that school email. There is also a separate smaller market, which has really surged since the Parkland shooting last year, of schools paying companies to monitor public social media accounts for keywords that might suggest a school shooting or a threat. And so that's very different, and that's a further incursion potentially into student privacy because it's monitoring outside of school and it's sort of monitoring by geolocation, looking at every account around a school. That's happening in Florida, and at least 60 school districts across the country are doing that.
60 school districts. Okay, doing that. But that's even sort of more pervasive than what you were largely focusing on. But how many districts are doing what you were talking about, that's monitoring those electronic communications within the accounts that they have access to?
So there's not a lot of transparency about this industry at all or how much school districts are doing. The best estimate I got from a privacy expert who's an expert on student privacy in particular is that perhaps as many as a third of school districts in America, so about 5,000 of the 15,000 school districts are already doing this. And about sort of, so that's 5,000 schools, as many as 5,000 school districts are doing it, maybe 10,000 are not. But that we're already talking about millions and millions of students who are already being surveilled.
Okay. And it's 24 hours a day. That's the advantage that the technology has. No matter where the student is, if they're using any one of these services, or if the school district is using the service, they can track the communications around the clock.
Exactly. And that also means that school districts and counselors and principals are being expected to respond sometimes 24 hours a day to a concerning email, waking up in the middle of the night to an alert, and sometimes calling the police to do a check-in in the middle of the night based on something one student emailed another.
I see. So have any school districts received pushback about this? Because, you know, at first glance, one can see a lot of advantages because so much of student communication is online, right? They're digital natives, and we keep hearing over and over again, if only someone had noticed something earlier, all sorts of harmful acts could have, whether it be to one's person or to schoolmates, could have been prevented. So it seems like there's some positives here, but have districts received pushback?
I haven't heard a lot of pushback yet, and I think in talking to privacy experts, they also say that a lot of students and parents aren't even aware of what's happening, that they might sort of be vaguely aware that, okay, their kid has a school laptop and the school is paying attention to it, but aren't aware of the sort of how pervasive the surveillance really is. You know, I did see on change.org a petition from a year ago from one school district where kids sort of thought that they didn't want to be monitored as much, and it got a couple of signatures and appeared to really go nowhere. But I think we don't really know yet how much pushback there is going to be because there's not a lot of awareness of what's actually happening.
Okay. But certainly there have to be some privacy concerns, if not from parents, then from civil libertarians.
Absolutely. I think privacy experts are tremendously concerned about this, especially because we know that in the past, pushes to make schools safer and to prevent school shootings have had really devastating unintended consequences. So as you're talking about the idea of sort of after Columbine to put more police officers in schools, to use more surveillance cameras, that civil liberties groups have seen that as really driving the school-to-prison pipeline and ending up criminalizing students for misbehavior in schools, something that had a hugely disproportionate effect on students of color and Black students in particular. And so there's this tremendous sad reality of life in the United States, which is that in the effort to prevent a very small number of white kids from shooting up their schools, there was a criminalization of student behavior that had sent an uncountable number of Black and brown kids towards the criminal justice system, creating tremendous harm to themselves, to their families. And we haven't even reckoned with that legacy fully. And now we're doing the whole thing over again, but this time online.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that a little later in the show because it is a major issue here, if not top of mind for parents at the moment. But we are talking about digital surveillance of students in American schools, whether or not they're on campus, and the idea that being able to track student electronic communications 24 hours a day could help prevent school shootings, could help keep students safe, could help alert adults if a student intends to harm themselves or perhaps someone else. But then as you're also hearing Lois Beckett talk about, there are concerns about student privacy. So we want to know what you think and if this is being used in your school district. I want to turn now to Jeff Patterson. He's joining us from Los Angeles. He's founder and CEO of Gaggle. Gaggle was founded in 1999 as a student email provider. Over time, it has expanded and now focuses on creating safe school environments. Jeff Patterson, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, tell us, I mean, how many schools do you serve right now?
So we serve approximately 1,400 school districts and schools. Those are our customers, our partners. I like to say we help protect about 4.5 million kids across the United States.
Four and a half million across the United States?
That's correct.
Okay. And do you have in all 50 states?
I'm almost certain all 50 states.
Okay. So how does it work? What exactly does Gaggle sort of take a look at? And what are the particular things that the software is looking for that might raise an alert?
Megan, can I tell you a short story?
Yes, please do.
So this is a story from one of our school district partners in the Midwest. And they really care about keeping kids safe. And so they've been partnering with us for a number of years. One morning, one of their students logged into her school-provided email account, and she sent an email to her friend. The email said, if you get this message, this is goodbye. You should go on living. I just can't. I will look down on you from heaven and strike down all your bad boyfriends. So what we do is we sit behind systems like Google Apps for Education, Office 365, the digital tools that are being provided. And much like Lois said, we ingest all this data. We have computer algorithms that flag things that are suspicious, and then a safety team that reviews those things 24 hours a day. In this case, the safety representative recognized this as a credible threat, so they called the school. The school, in turn, called home, but they also sent a resource officer out into the building. When the officer went into the women's restroom, the officer found the girl hanging in the school bathroom. They were able to save her, but it was within about a minute of her passing away. And that story happened over 700 times this last school year. So we're looking for bullying, threats of school violence, fighting, bringing weapons to school. We see lots and lots of self-harm, lots of suicide ideation, and other things as well.
So that's a tough story, but you just want to be sure that I heard you correctly, Jeff, that the officials found the student in time, just barely in time?
They did. Now, again, that story happened over 700 times that we count as a life saved. Like, they're not always that dramatic, but there are lots and lots that are.
Okay. But you said that when some communication gets flagged, it doesn't automatically alert officials in school officials in the district, that it goes through like a team of people take a look at it first to decide whether or not it's a credible threat?
That's right. We want to eliminate all false alerts. And so we're looking for what something is really, truly actionable. And so someone talking about shooting hoops, you know, or they killed it on the math test, we're not looking at those things. You know, once we see those things, we resolve them. And so we're just contacting the school when it's something that is concerning.
Okay, because Lois Beckett, chime in here, because I think that might be one of the questions that pops up into people's minds, is that, you know, kids say a lot of things, and, you know, they might even say something more severe than shooting hoops, because they're just trying out different selves. They're you know, they may not mean anything, even if they say something that sounds a little extreme. How can you tell the difference?
I think that's a real challenge. And obviously, as Jeff is pointing out, having a layer of human employees to look at these automatic alerts may keep students from getting flagged for, like, talking about their school paper on To Kill a Mockingbird, which is something that has happened in the past. But also having adults trying to interpret what students are saying is also tricky, particularly if those adults come from a different region in the country or a different cultural background. So, you know, you can improve the interpretation of student comments, but, you know, students are sometimes have rap lyrics that they're interpreted as real threats. There's always a challenge there. And certainly there are really powerful stories of lives saved, and I've heard that from school officials. And when you hear a story about a kid whose life is saved in a dramatic way, one school official told me, like, how can I not pay for this? No matter, you know, how tight our budget is, how can I not pay for this technology that might just save a life? But what's a lot harder to measure is the impact of those false alarms, or even the impact of something that wasn't that serious and now has escalated and now there's police at the door. And we live in a country where, safety checks from police officers sometimes end in people with very disturbing, you know, in a very disturbed state getting shot to death. And so, you know, that is not a situation that's necessarily safe for students to be in either, even if the intention is so good, even if the intention is to save their life.
Well, Lois and Jeff, hang on here. Let's just turn to the phones for a moment. We're talking about digital surveillance 24 hours a day of American students, of K-12 students largely, and if that is actually effective in improving school safety. So let's go to Alex, who's calling from Harrisburg, South Dakota. Alex, you're on the air.
Hello.
Go ahead.
As a former educator, I used to be in K-12, I've seen what digital communication surveillance has really been a benefit for the school district in helping prevent bullying, self-harm, or potential acts of violence. Data is widely used. We're surveilled, you know, quite a bit through social media, whenever we call in, whenever we accept a disclosure or terms of service. So really, I feel the benefits for using that data, it is really beneficial for the most part that I've seen.
Okay, great. Alex, thank you so much for your call. Jeff Patterson, let me ask you, Alex mentioned bullying. Does the system monitor bullying?
We do. We're watching for anything that would be really inappropriate language directed at another student, right? That would be harassment. That's one of the categories we do. You know, I might describe it this way. Our schools are giving kids these devices, usually a Chromebook or a laptop. They're giving them internet access. They're giving them these accounts to communicate and collaborate. These are essentially a digital playground, and no one would suggest that we have a physical playground, a big jungle gym out on the asphalt without fences and recess monitors. And that's what we're trying to do, is try and provide that digital safety net for the students.
Lois Beckett, is that how school districts tend to see it, as a digital safety net?
You know, a lot of school districts are very excited about this technology because a lot of parents are very concerned about what their students are doing online and really want to know what's happening there have even been cases where parents have sued schools in issues of suicide or bullying for not doing enough. So schools are certainly facing pressure from parents to do more to take care of kids. But what's different about digital surveillance from checking up on a playground is that digital surveillance does create a track record of incidents that will go on students' records. And when I talk to parents, that's one of the things that they're most afraid about with this new technology, is that if my student accidentally searches for something controversial on their school computer and then that gets flagged, is that going to go in my 8-year-old's record forever? Is that going to follow him or her for throughout their entire life? And they just have no idea what's going to happen for something a kid does when they're so young.
Well, we will ask Jeff Patterson to respond to that when we come back from a quick break. So Lois Beckett and Jeff Patterson hanging here for just a second. We are talking about digital surveillance of students and whether it can help keep schools and students safe. Does it sound like the right move in the digital age, or are you concerned about student privacy and the long-term effects of this data following a student even as they get older? This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about digital surveillance of American students and how more and more school districts across the country are turning to technology to keep an eye on what students are saying and doing online around the clock. The idea is to keep students safe, to keep their school communities safe. But there's also concerns about what happens to that data, about school, about student privacy, and about the general idea that maybe we're just getting kids more and more used to learning to live in a world where they're being constantly surveilled. I'm joined today by Lois Beckett. She's a senior reporter for The Guardian. She reported on this story in a piece headlined "Under Digital Surveillance: How American Schools Spy on Millions of Kids." And Jeff Patterson joins us as well. He's founder and CEO of Gaggle. It's a company that serves approximately 1,400 school districts across the country, with serving about 4.5 million students using Gaggle's technology of digital surveillance here. Now, Jeff Patterson, before the break, Lois Beckett was talking about concerns that some parents have about what happens to the data if a student gets some of their communications flagged when they're young, but even if it turns out to be no big deal, do those get scrubbed out of their file? Does it stay with them forever? What happens to that?
So let me make the point first that this is not about discipline. This is really about teachable moments, about kids that are engaged in dangerous behaviors, that are in crisis, and how do we reach out and help those students? There's an administrator that she had a saying. She told me she doesn't use Gaggle for the bad kids. She uses it for the sad kids. And so I want to just make sure that we keep that in mind. It's so in terms of the data that we collect, we do purge that after a period of time that's agreed upon by the district. Generally, it's within one school year. And again, it's not about sort of someone searching for a controversial topic. The educators I know encourage their students to explore all sorts of controversial topics because they want the kids curious and learning.
So you say it gets purged after a year about, and so then
generally about a year.
Okay, and then it's gone forever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's go to Megan, who's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Megan, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm calling because I am alarmed. I have a private psychiatric practice. I treat children and adults. And I'm sorry, this may be well-intended, and it probably is, but I can see it as a slippery slope and far too easily abused. It may be that some schools and districts are looking for, as you say, the sad kids rather than the bad kids. But that doesn't mean that they all are, and I think it could too easily be used to monitor conversations for sexual content, to pick up signs of illegal activity. You know, I treat teenagers, and they tend to shoplift or drink or use drugs, and I'm alarmed, and I think that we are trying to use technology and for-profit companies to take the place of close relationships with our kids, that rather than parents monitoring their technology and knowing their kids and talking with them personally, now we're going to hire some company to go through their conversations. I also would be interested in knowing, so are they also monitoring the conversations among all of the staff and faculty? I just see this as a bad move.
Okay, Megan, thank you for your call. Jeff Patterson, I'll turn to you. First of all, about the question of monitoring staff and faculty communications. Does Gaggle do that?
Yeah, so there's an occasional school district that wants to monitor the staff, right? And they've got some good reasons for doing so. The reality is these accounts are owned by the organization. Whether you're a company, a government agency, or a school district, these accounts are owned by the entity, and the entity is responsible for keeping them safe and used appropriately. Speaking to sort of Megan's role working with kids, I thank her for doing that. This is really what it's all about, is identifying those kids that really need a Megan in their life. And I have three teenage daughters. You don't know what's going on in your own kids' heads, even if you're there, engage with them all the time. And certainly from the educator's standpoint, it's hard to know which kids are struggling.
So Lois Beckett, have you heard, to Megan's point about this being a slippery slope and the sort of the search terms or the kinds of communications that might be flagged in systems like this expanding? Right. She was talking about, you know, would schools start monitoring content if kids were talking about sex? Have you heard about that anywhere?
Oh, that's absolutely happening. And in fact, Jeff's company, Gaggle, is already monitoring students' emails and documents for references to sexuality, for drug and alcohol use. Gaggle actually, in many school districts, will send an automated email to students every time they use a swear word. Most districts, I understand, at Gaggle have that. So we're already talking about technology that's put in place often with the intention of stopping the most severe behavior, self-harm, school shootings, cyberbullying, but is in fact already monitoring a wide variety of student misbehavior, things that schools don't like. One school in Colorado, one official told me that a student wrote an email to a teacher ratting out some other kids who were going to go smoke weed in a bathroom. And that official said, like, within minutes, the troops were deployed to deal with that situation. So already this technology is being used to monitor much smaller misbehaviors than very serious things.
Okay, so Jeff Patterson, I mean, we've been focused a lot on safety issues, which are paramount in the minds of many. I'm not going to question that. But you know, Lois just said that Gaggle will flag swear words or maybe conversations possibly about sexuality. That seems to be veering definitely into sort of behavior shaping territory here. Isn't that concerning?
So, as I think you mentioned, the company was started 20 years ago, and social mores have been changing what we want to achieve with students. Digital citizenship is still a big topic, and many schools want to make sure the kids are using their tools effectively. You know, we have a number of our customers from the past that continue to want us to alert the students when they're using things inappropriate, using curse words, if you will. We've been encouraging our customers not to use that functionality, right? We think there's greater safety and security, and the reality is that this is not where the social norms are for most schools and communities. In terms of the sexuality, let me give you an example. We see numerous instances where students will offer sexual services on a system like Craigslist and interact with adults, right? That's the type of sexuality that we're looking to prevent, or that we're looking to alert a school district to know that this is a kid that's making some bad choices, right? There are some other things that are happening on school grounds, whether it's drug use or other inappropriate behaviors. The school administrators want to know about these things so they can prevent bigger problems.
So for those, for the communications regarding sexuality, do they go through the same process that we were talking about violent communications beforehand? So things get flagged and people then end up looking at it first before it's forwarded to the district?
That's correct. correct. We need to make sure that we're only sending the district the things that they really would know and care about and want to act on.
Okay. Well, I want to just play a moment here of some tape from another person that we talked to in the process of getting ready for this show. We spoke with Aura Tanner. She's a Tech Policy Hub Fellow at the Aspen Institute, where she researches the intersection of education and technology. And she said that the surveillance of students and data collection can and will disproportionately affect students of color.
The data being collected is biased against African-American and students with disabilities because they are written up at higher rates for discipline compared to other student groups. Also, they tend to get more punitive outcomes due to over-surveilling, and the interactions with these students and law enforcement often ends up in arrests and expulsions.
Jeff Pedersen, this is something that Lois Beckett brought up beforehand in the show, and I just wanted to get you to respond to that, because historically, yes, it's true, African-American students have been disproportionately disciplined here. Is there a risk of that just being further scaled up with this form of digital surveillance?
So I don't think that's, again, it's not about discipline. It's about kids engaged in dangerous or inappropriate activities, right? And whether those students are white and middle class, or from a minority background, that really doesn't matter to us. We want to protect all kids. We want to be heroes for kids. And so what we're doing is we're alerting the schools to things that they would want to know about so they can intervene to help these kids. It's not about discipline. And oftentimes, some of the kids in these marginalized groups are the ones that we're protecting the most. They're the ones that are being bullied, that are being harassed, that maybe need more of this help.
And just before I forget, Jeff, there's another important question I should ask you. Does Gaggle sell the data or analysis gleaned from the data in any way?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Absolutely not. So the data belongs to the school system.
Okay. Lois Beckett, you profiled several other companies in your reporting. Is anyone else selling the data that they get?
I'm not aware of that, and that there is a federal law that protects the privacy of educational records. And so what we're looking at here, I'm not aware of any selling of this data, certainly selling of the data before it's anonymized. But a more serious concern that I've heard from parents is how this might be used for students and disciplinary records going on. And certainly some of these records can be subpoenaed by law enforcement. So that's more of a concern.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Chris is calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, good to talk to you.
Go ahead.
I was calling in because I've lived through a school shooting. I'm sorry, this may be hard for me to kind of get out. Mm. It was the Northern Illinois University shooting in 2008. And I was in the room basically an hour before the shooter attacked. So I missed being a target basically by chance, is how I kind of look at it nowadays. And I just wanted to add the perspective on this discussion for especially your listeners about the idea of using this technology to prevent a school shooting. I feel like that's kind of a security blanket that's meant to make people feel better for the fact that the federal government, state and local governments aren't doing anything on gun policy to address the underlying issue of these school shootings. Things like background checks, like red flag laws, like safe storage laws, common sense things that we could be doing. And I don't want people to forget that, because there are shootings where it's not a student involved. Mm-hmm. At NIU, it was an undergraduate, or it was a graduate student who had left the university, I believe. At Sandy Hook, it wasn't a student at that school. This isn't going to be something that can really stop school shootings. People will hide their behavior, offline, their communication offline. So It's not necessarily really a solution. It's kind of a Band-Aid for a bigger problem.
Yeah. Chris, thank you so much for calling and for sharing your story and for bringing this perspective to the conversation. Thank you. Lois, let me turn to you, because Chris brings up a set of really good points here, because we started this conversation near the beginning of your reporting saying that many more districts are turning to this kind of surveillance or began to after the Parkland school shooting here. But, I mean, is there evidence that increasing surveillance reduces school shootings?
There is no evidence that this kind of digital surveillance helps prevent violence in schools. And in fact, there really isn't any evidence that any school safety measures prevent very rare school shootings or do much to prevent violence in schools. And it is absolutely the case gun control policies, including things like red flag laws, which enable parents or law enforcement or sometimes even schools to have people's guns temporarily confiscated when they're in a very dangerous moment. There is some evidence that that prevents suicide, that that prevents people from dying. And this technology, there is as yet no evidence on whether it works or not. But surveillance is much more politically palatable than gun control. And in fact, Senate Republicans who are single-handedly blocking the passage of any serious federal gun control laws last week introduced an alternative set of policies to prevent school shootings without much evidence behind them. And among those was a proposal to mandate this kind of digital surveillance in all public schools across the country, making it obligatory for public schools to monitor students' online activities for threats of self-harm or violence. Chris has very powerful perspective. He's bringing up something which is absolutely the case, which is that there is no federal gun control in this country, and instead there is a push to invest in completely unproven technologies with the best of intentions of keeping kids safe. Right. But we have no belief, no evidence to show that that will work.
Well, I just want to see if I can sneak in a couple more callers really quickly before we run out of time. So let's go to Kamen, who's calling from Waupaca, Wisconsin. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm just calling in because the kids learn right away not to use those school emails. They use their own personal addresses. And I think maybe one of the best preventions would be to teach the kids that if they hear something, to share it, because they're not trying to get someone in trouble, but to try and keep them out of trouble. There was an instance here not too long ago where the boy had been threatening for a couple of years, and the kids all knew, but the school didn't. So if the kids were empowered to share concern early on, and I think that would be probably the best way. They all had their social media to share the warnings about the kid after he'd been arrested. He had a couple of other kids that were going to carry out his mission, and the kids through social media all connected and stayed home from school the next day thinking someone else was going to show up. I think that just empowering the children to know that they can help and keep their friends or, students out of trouble and alive would be the way to go.
Well, Kamen, thank you so much for your call. Lois, I'm going to ask you one more question before we're out of time here. Are there concerns that if communications get flagged, but a child hasn't yet done anything, that law enforcement could still be brought into their lives? And perhaps, we might enter a stage, we've already seen this in, at least in Vermont, if I remember, charges being brought against them, even if they haven't actually done anything yet.
This is absolutely a concern, and I am following several cases across the country where this has happened. And one of the things that's really hard is that the reason these technologies are popular is that we know that very often before these horrific school shootings, that there are warning signs that different people have spotted concerning things, sometimes online, sometimes not. But it is the case that there are a lot of troubled young men in this country saying things, talking to their friends about things that they want to do or making dumb jokes. And if that gets part of their permanent record and starts building a case against them, that can really completely ruin someone's life. And I've seen that happen.
Well, Lois Beckett, senior reporter for The Guardian, her article, Under Digital Surveillance, How American Schools Spy on Millions of Kids. We've got a link to that at onpointradio.org. Lois, thank you so much.
Thanks.
And Jeff Patterson, founder and CEO of Gaggle. Jeff, I very much appreciate you coming on today and helping us understand this new technology. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.